Welcome back to Killer Stories. I'm your host, Bobby Holmes. This week, I have a special guest joining me on the show. Please welcome Jennifer Barlow. Jennifer, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, definitely. So Jennifer and I were connected through a mutual friend, and she just finished writing a book about her uncle, who was convicted of a murder that took place in 1996. So, of course, our mutual friend had told her about my podcast, and here we are, ready to talk about her uncle and the book. So, Jennifer, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and your background?
So, I was a teacher for the last 10 years. The last 8 years, I was teaching high school English. So, writing and reading are just passions of mine. And I decided last year I really wanted to take this opportunity to step away from work and write this story about my uncle. It's been something that I've been wanting to do for several years, and it just felt like the right time. So that's what I've spent the last 8 months doing, is writing this story.
Wow. No, that's really, it's inspiring to quit your job to put everything into something like this. And you're from New York originally. That's where this took place.
Yes. So I'm from upstate New York. That's where I was born. But my dad and his family, they were from the Bronx originally, and then Long Island, which is where this story is taking place. And then I have moved around New York, Boston, New York City, Utah.
Right. That was my next question, because we're both in Utah now. So I wanted to know how you ended up in Utah.
It was just a sort of random, wanted to try something new. And I wanted to go someplace where I knew someone. So it was Indiana or Utah.
Mm-hmm. Hey, that's kind of why we're here. It was just an opportunity that came up that we jumped on. So, yeah. So back to the book, it's finished, correct? You're just working on the publishing stage of things.
That's correct. So I have my manuscript finished, and I've been sending out letters to literary agents. Hopefully my query letter will intrigue one of them, and we'll move on to the next stages and get it published the traditional route.
So I read through your proposal excerpts, and the book is heavily focused on your uncle, Stephen Manolis, and mm-hmm. his mental illness, and the fact that your belief is he was wrongly convicted. Jennifer, would you mind telling us more about your uncle from your perspective?
So my uncle, Stephen, he was born in 1960. He was the youngest of three sons, and he was born in the Bronx, and they lived there until he was about six, I believe. And then the family moved to East Northport, which is where they remained. So he had what we would consider a typical normal childhood. He was social. He hung out with his cousins. There's lots of family pictures of these younger years of him out to dinner, out to restaurants, swimming, having fun. He did well in school. He played sports. And he graduated high school, and he enrolled at Stony Brook in pre-med studies. And he did okay for the first little bit. His classes were mostly like focused in the pre-med area, and they slowly started to change. B's went to F's. He had this girlfriend at the time who my family believed to be a bad influence, and they based this on conversations that they overheard between the two. And around this time, he was arrested for stealing a car and also this girl's ring from her dorm room. Because of that, he was sentenced to probation and also psychiatric evaluation. Now, he did go to the first few check-ins for his probation, and then he stopped. So he was sent a summons to appear in court, which he did. He carried on with the psychological evaluation. And my grandfather actually wrote a 5-page letter to the judge, sort of explaining everything that was going on. And the judge dropped the probation, and that was it. That was the end of it. But around this same time is when his reclusion essentially began. He never re-enrolled in any classes. He never went back to school. And he mostly, from that point, stayed in his home until he was arrested.
Well, see, so this is interesting, because I listened to this case on another podcast. I believe it was mm-hmm. Anatomy of a Murder, Nightmare Next Door, it was called. And it's just yeah. funny how they can take details and twist them, because I'm sure you know more exactly how it went, and going to court and having probation actually dropped, because they make it seem like, I know you said he kind of stopped his check-ins, but they made it seem like mm-hmm. probation officers just kind of gave up and stopped checking on him instead. And that doesn't sound like how it really went down.
Right. That's right. I did hear that as well on this podcast, which was just very recently published. But yes, and he was arrested and brought to court when he stopped going to his check-ins. But then that letter was sent to the judge, and the judge made the decision to drop his probation.
Let's maybe just take it back and start with the crime itself and then kind of go from there. In 1996, 16-year-old Kristen Scarabelli was murdered and her body was discarded in some trees about 6 houses away from her own. She went home alone that evening, and when her family returned, they assumed she went to stay at a friend's. But the next morning, when Kristen's friend came looking for her, they realized that she was missing. Her body was well concealed, and a canine search dog helped in her discovery 2 days later. She had been strangled. And the part that really irks me about this case is that multiple neighbors heard her screams and a man or someone saying, "Shut up or I'll kill you," yet they didn't call police.
She had been to her house with a friend that night, and then she drove that friend home, came back home. They spoke on the phone, which was the last known contact. That was about 10:45. And then about 11 o'clock, so 15 minutes later, neighbors reported the next day that they had heard screams of varying degrees. Some people said they just heard screams. Some people said they heard help. Some people said they heard "shut up or I'll kill you." They knew where it was coming from. Some of them even said they believed they knew who it was coming from. But even though they may have looked outside, gone downstairs, looked outside a window, one gentleman said he left his house and walked down the street a little bit, that nobody saw anything. And then they didn't pursue anything further. Nobody called the police. Nobody called the home. Nobody went over to check. And then 20 minutes after that, about 11:20, her parents came home. And then about midnight, her brother came home. But you're correct that nothing seemed out of the ordinary. Her mother testified that it was normal for her to be sleeping over at a friend's house, even on a school night. And then the next morning, when her ride showed up for school and she wasn't there, that's really what got the parents calling friends to see where she was. When they realized nobody knew where she was, they eventually called the police. At this point, it was just a missing person's case. But when the police came and they started questioning the neighbors and they told them what they had heard, they realized there was some suspicion.
And even though there were other persons of interest, one being a teenage boy, Jimmy Marr, who had seemed to have motive and even once threatened to kill Kristen, another was a man in Georgia who straight up confessed to the murder. The only suspect in the eyes of the Scarabellis and the police was Stephen Manolis. And the man from Georgia, I believe his last name was Shalinsky,
yes.
Grew up in Long Island, which is the same area, right? And he stated that he tried to date Kristen, but the police believe that he gave a false confession because he was homeless and he thought prison would be a better option than being homeless. So I don't know. I mean, we can, like I said, go through all the theories, but those are the two that I saw that seemed to be easily written off.
Exactly.
The Scarabellis assumed it was Stephen from the get-go, right? Just because, no offense to label him, they think he's like the creepy weird guy in the neighborhood.
Absolutely, yes.
So let's maybe just discuss any evidence that's found at the crime scene, which was very little. one being right. A white button. So I think, was that found on the Scarabelli's lawn? Or
that was found on the Scarabelli lawn, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so they had the button was found on the lawn. And I think one of the most important things that people need to remember as we talk about the button is the proximity, because the grass, right, the Scarabelli lawn touched the driveway of my family's home, of Stephen's home. There's no separation. There's no fence. So this is very close proximity. But yes, the button, there was a button, a white button, 3-hole, found on the Scarabelli lawn, which was collected when they did their initial, when the forensic scientists came in and were investigating the area, picking up anything that could potentially become evidence. Sure. I mean, this button became really what the detectives focused on. This became the center of everything. This was picked up by media. This was, you know, they made it seem like they had found this golden ticket. Mm-hmm. But really, when we look at what this so-called evidence had to do with the crime, it wasn't really anything.
Potentially nothing. They assume it is Stephen's because he wore the same thing, not necessarily the same article of clothing, almost like a uniform. He's got his white button-down shirt, and so they assume this button belongs to him. And at this time, I don't think they have the forensic science capability to test it, right? They just hang on to it.
That's correct. There was a five and a half year gap between the murder and when my uncle was arrested. So within these 5 years, the DNA testing had become more sophisticated and they were able to test this button. And the button itself with the DNA was kind of interesting because it was a degraded sample. Mm-hmm. So when the forensic scientist testified, he said at first when he did this quantitation process, as he calls it, it didn't show any human DNA on it. But once the button and the thread that was attached to it was cleaned up, was concentrated, he was able to get what he called a partial profile. So there's two types of DNA testing that are happening in this case. On the button, they did STR testing, which is nuclear DNA. That's what links each person's individual DNA. It can link you to an actual person. The other type of testing that they did was mitochondrial DNA, which can only link to a maternal line. So the button was tested with the nuclear DNA, and they look at these 14 areas. One of those is gender. So out of those 14, they had 5 matches. So they concluded that it was male gender and that the 4 other, as they call them, loci, 4 out of 13 were a match to Stephen.
But they didn't have his DNA to match to it until he was arrested, right? Or did they gather his DNA prior?
They did have DNA. They took garbage and they found some semen on a napkin, which they concluded later, once they actually took Stephen's DNA after his arrest, that was in fact Stephen's. Up until that point, it was an assumption. Mm-hmm. But yes, they did have his actual DNA at the time of his arrest. And what they had done prior to that was matched the DNA from the button, that partial profile, to the semen napkin and concluded that that was a match.
Gotcha. Well, leading up to the ability to test the button, they had some other fun tactics to try to get him to confess. I heard of them putting up a birdhouse in the Scarabelli's yard with a picture of Kristen and a hidden camera behind her picture. Mm-hmm. And they were attempting to get him. Well, he only came out at night. He's pretty much stayed in the house during the day.
Yeah. I mean, night. He was a recluse. He didn't talk to people outside of our little family unit. And so he would go outside at night, kind of stay in the front yard, maybe walk a little. And it wasn't like an every night type of thing. But if he were to go outside, it would be at night because there'd be less people for him to encounter, to talk to.
But he found this birdhouse. He did approach it, but he's a smart guy. He easily discovered this camera, right?
Yes. So this didn't come up in trial. So everything that I based it on, I mean, we have our family stories, but in writing the book, everything that I put in there is from the testimonies. And so this wasn't really brought up. This was talked about on the other podcast, but it wasn't a part of the trial. But the detectives did testify in the trial that they had probably gone to the house in various ways to watch him maybe 50 times over those 5 years. And they say that he found them every time.
Yeah. I heard them say that they put up multiple cameras and he broke them.
They said that, I don't know, because it wasn't in trial, but I do know in trial they said, you know, they might have been in someone's backyard and he would let them know by like flashing a light at them. I know you're there.
Yeah.
And the Scarabellis did put cameras in their house, whether that was of the police's urging or the Scarabellis, I'm not sure, but they did put cameras up in their windows, which faced our house. One of them faced the room that my sister and I always slept in. And my uncle knew they were there. He told us about them. He showed them to us so that we were making sure that we had the curtain closed, that we weren't, you know, changing with these cameras. I didn't at the time know really what the cameras were for. It wasn't until later I realized after his arrest that they were maybe to scare him. There was never anything reported as far as camera footage from them. So maybe it was just never turned on. There was never anything reported by those cameras.
So how old were you when this was happening?
When the crime actually occurred, I was like 6 or 7. Okay. I am familiar vaguely with, I remember my mother baked cookies and brought them over. Mm-hmm. But I was too young at the time to really understand what was going on. But also at the time, like, the police had initially questioned my uncle the day after, like they did with the entire neighborhood, essentially. They checked the house just like they did the surrounding area. Nobody knew that he remained at the forefront of their minds because they talked to him that second, the day after her murder on the 13th. And then obviously he knew that they were watching him. That wasn't a conversation that he ever had with us. But until he was arrested, we didn't know.
The rest of the families, yeah.
So I was 12 when he was arrested. I was 15 when his trial started.
One other tactic that they were trying to gather his DNA, I guess, earlier, that they sent a letter hoping that he would sign it and lick the envelope and then return it, which he did return it, but he didn't lick the envelope. Again, he is a smart guy. And but he signed it Kyle Stewart. So do you want to talk a little bit about Kyle?
So one of the things, and like I said, I did listen to this podcast, and unfortunately, the lead detective didn't review the case. This was like a big selling point for them. It was actually Kyle Sterling, but they did say that in the podcast. They had it incorrect, but it was Kyle Sterling. But that was a name that the police tried to say was his way of matching these initials to Kristen Scarabelli. But my uncle had been using that name since the late 70s. And my grandparents, my other uncle, they all testified the same thing in trial. He'd been using that name since the 70s. They had ideas of where they thought it came from, but it was really, you know, when he would call sweepstakes numbers, he would use that name. When he would order catalogs, he would use that name. It was never something that he asked us to call him. He did get angry if we didn't use it. These detectives, this didn't come up in trial either, but the detectives did come to our house in upstate and they questioned my sister when my parents were not home. And they asked her the same thing. How long had he been using that name? And she said, as long as she could remember. Gotcha. And she was 18 at the time. So he had been going by this name for a while. One of the psychiatrists said that this could be like an alter ego. Mm-hmm. He never acted different. Depending on what name he was using, he was always the same person. So whether it was an alter ego or simply a name change, I can only, you know, come up with my own assumptions about that. But he was always the same person. He didn't change his personality based on what name he was using. But when they were interrogating him, this name did come up. And the evaluation that he underwent after his arrest, again, the psychiatrist said this would have been his alter ego. She believed that during his interrogation, he was in the midst of a schizophrenic episode.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. He is mentally ill. He's diagnosed with schizophrenia because it sounds like DID or dissociative identity disorder, which kind of, I guess, multiple personalities. But if you feel like he's not acting different between using one name to another, then maybe that doesn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah. And I do think that there's been some changes in psychiatry in the last 26 years, because he underwent that first evaluation in 83, 84. And then again, he had one from both the defense and the prosecution. Mm-hmm. And the doctor, her name is Dr. Barbara Kerwin. She's the one that conducted his evaluations after his arrest for the defense. And she's actually a renowned psychiatrist. She's used all the time to catch people lying about mental illness. That's sort of what her job is now. If someone's trying to use like plead insanity, she will go in and essentially see if they're telling the truth. And that wasn't anything that Stephen was trying to do. In fact, she'll even say in his report, he tried at all times to come off as sane and rational. And he doesn't believe that there is a mental illness.
Right.
Which is why this has been so hard. Because he's not fighting for himself, because he processes this differently.
So I'm going to say a claim that I heard on that other podcast, and just to see if you can elaborate on that. But they were trying to dig up more dirt on Stephen, I guess, to try to link him to this case. And they claim while in college, a girl said that he raped her, but didn't press charges. And then she also said that he continued to call her for the next 16 years and he would never say anything, just hang up when she answered. Do you know anything about that?
So I believe some of that information came up during the grand jury, which is information that I don't have. Those are not transcripts that I have. I do know that this is the same girl that my grandparents believed to be a bad influence.
His girlfriend at one time.
This was his girlfriend, yes. I mean, that's what the detective said in that podcast. It wasn't brought up in trial. There was nothing ever reported. It didn't, I can't say one way or the other, but based on the information I have, there's nothing that proves that or indicates that. In terms of the calling, again, she didn't report anything, so it's not like people were checking phone records. After 16 years, him being a recluse, how would he know where she lived?
Yeah.
Right? When he last knew her, she was living in a dorm room. So like I said, I don't have that much information about that because I don't have grand jury minutes, and I don't also have some of the things that the detectives had or things that were mentioned on that podcast because they weren't introduced at trial. I mean, my family has their perception of that relationship.
I know one thing that I did want to touch on was his actual arrest and how that went, because I read through that part of your transcript that you sent over, and it did not seem like he was treated like your normal knock on the door, put you in cuffs and a nice padded car to go downtown, was it?
It was not. Yes, I would love to speak on this. I think before I even talk about the arrest, again, it's important to remember at the time of his arrest, he had been a recluse for almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. And the police knew this, the detectives knew this, but he was also a germaphobe. And he had been like that for quite a while. And so there are several things that are working against him at this moment when he's being arrested. But it started on October 9th. There was a meeting with 14 detectives, the team leader, and 13 other people. And they put this plan in place to arrest him, but they did not have an arrest warrant. And the reason that they will state in their testimonies that they did not receive an arrest warrant is because the law at the time, and I don't know if it has changed, but at the time in New York, if you had an arrest warrant signed by a judge, that also gave that suspect the automatic right to counsel. And they did not want him to come with counsel because they wanted to talk to him without a lawyer present. But they knew that this was going to be difficult because they couldn't cross his threshold, but he's a recluse. So how are they going to get him outside? So they had a plan that if he did not come outside far enough away from the house, that they would use this blinking light that they had made that would be affixed to the telephone pole and point to the house, knowing based on the times that they had watched him that he was protective of the home. If anything was going on, he would be likely to go outside and investigate into what it was. So they waited several hours, and shortly before midnight, he had come out a few times, but not far enough away for them to arrest him. So shortly before midnight, they had that light put on the pole, telephone pole, right in front of the house. And sure enough, it only took about a minute or so for him to come outside. And the detective said that he was carrying a pole, which they later determined to be the pool skimming pole. And he was trying to knock this light off. And one detective's job was, she was sitting in an area where they had had the street lights turned off so that it was dark so that she could use like night vision and see this more clearly. She told the team leader that he was far enough away from the house, and he gave the word, and these 10 detectives began running after him in all different directions. They testified that he went toward the front door and then veered toward the side door where he was pinned. There was a violent struggle, essentially 10 to 1. They wrestled him to the ground, they shackled him, and they handcuffed him behind his back. And he was carried to a van that was pulled up in front of the house. And he was thrown in the back of the van. And the detectives testified that there were only two seats in the van, one for the driver and the front passenger. and Stephen remained on the back on the floor with three other detectives. And again, for the first 15 or so minutes, they testified that it was continually a violent struggle, that they were sitting on him. They testified that he said he couldn't breathe because they were sitting on top of him, sometimes face up, sometimes face down. Again, he's shackled at his feet, he's handcuffed. And eventually he settled down, asked them what was going on. And they said, you know, you're being taken in for this murder. And he said, I had nothing to do with that. I don't know what you're talking about. But again, also in my book, I try to emphasize, I don't want the reader or people to forget what that would have been like. That's going to be a stressful situation for someone who doesn't have a mental illness.
Right.
But for someone who has been a recluse for so long, who hadn't been touched in so long, hadn't spoken or really been around anyone other than his immediate family, how jarring this experience would have been for him to be lured out of his house like that and then to be essentially chased after and being touched aggressively by so many people.
After the arrest, I saw something about waiving his rights, that he signed, he signed a card.
Yes. So the detective that was in the front of the van, after he said after 15 minutes, Stephen had calmed down and he read him his Miranda rights. And then once he was in the interrogation room, the detectives that were interrogating also then read him his constitutional rights, and they had him sign a card, which is, there's a picture of it in my book. It does have his signature on it. A handwriting expert came in and tested it and said that was his signature. He denied signing it. But again, if we look at the psychiatric evaluation, the question was he in his right mind to do so, knowingly, willingly, and intelligently in his right mind to do so? Mm-hmm. There's a very important point that I would like to touch on. And this is to do, I talk about this in the story in one of my later chapters. After Stephen was arrested and his interrogation began, something that my family has always struggled with, and I think a lot of people struggle with, actually, I know that to be true because people have lobbied for this law to change, is that his interrogations, they were never recorded with video or audio. So he never confessed, and several detectives would say that he continued to deny that he had anything to do with this. But they did say that he made some peculiar statements under this name, Kyle Sterling. Mm-hmm. So as he's in this interrogation, it seems like he's becoming more detached from Stephen. Stephen's becoming a brother and not him. And he begins using the name Kyle Sterling. And they, you know, had a whole list of things that he said, mostly not really anything of importance. And then they used some alleged statements against him. And when Stephen's lawyer asked them, well, where's the audio? Where's the video? And they said, oh, we don't do that. And he's like, well, what, you know, basically came out as, what do you have? And they really just had notes, and they didn't have the questions written down. They testified, we didn't write the questions down, just Stephen's answers in sum and substance, basically in summary. So we're not getting the full picture. Now, these detectives also testified that they lied to try and get him to confess. They yelled at him. They swore at him. They were using deceit, and they could not get a confession. So when they are using these statements in court, and the prosecution would say, or the prosecutor, excuse me, would say, okay, so you asked this and he responded with this, they'd say yes. But that's actually not true because we don't know what they asked. There's no record of those questions. And now this is happening. The trial's happening 3 years later. Do they remember their questions exactly? Probably not. And how easy for the prosecutor to take these sound bites. We don't know what the detective said to get those responses, right? Was he lying? Was he yelling? Did they just take one part of Stephen's answer? Did they take the whole thing? It's just, we have no idea because there's no record. And actually in the same county that he was arrested in, that was a big deal. They've been investigated before. There's New York Times articles as far back as 1979 writing about coerced confessions that were taking place. And so in 2010, the law was changed and it's now mandatory to videotape felony interrogations. And that was done through people lobbying, Innocence Project lobbying, people who had been wrongly convicted or who had even confessed, but they were coerced confessions, all lobbying for this change. And it's so important because how do you know, especially in this case?
Yeah. Yeah, I can't believe that even in that, well, 2000, is that what year it was? 2001?
Well, yeah, 2001 is when he's arrested, when he's being interrogated. And all of the detectives that testified, they were asked over and over, do you really think that notes, that your summarized notes are a better way to preserve fact and truth than recording it? And they all said yes.
Interesting.
They all believed that their notes were superior to recording. And an important part to remember here is it's not just what people say, why it should be recorded. It's because you get to see the environment. You get to see what condition they're in. You get to see how they're being treated, but you also get to see their body language, their tone of voice. There's so much that goes into watching it and getting the full picture. Because just like the prosecutor did, you can read a statement, you can put any tone you want, you can put any inflections and inferences you want in that. But is that how it was really said? And is it really in that context? Was that 10 minutes after they made previous comments and now we're just piecing it together however we want to get it as close to as a confession as we can because we don't actually have one? We don't know. Now, Stevens, in his evaluation, the psychiatrist said it is a shame that they did not record this because if they had, they would have seen him in the midst of a schizophrenic episode, complete with delusions and hallucinations, and it would have shown his mental state at the time of his interrogations. And she said it would have been a textbook case of a schizophrenic man who had just been through this great ordeal in his arrest, not in his right mind, being questioned this way after he'd been essentially beat up. He's got a black eye, he's got scratches, he's bruised.
Yeah, wow. That would have made a huge difference, I think, in the case as well. Going into trial, the evidence that they have is basically this button. Is there anything else that they are saying could tie him to this murder?
Yeah. So the two pieces that they consider their strong evidence was this button that had a partial profile, DNA profile of Stephen, and also a hair that was linked to the maternal line of Stephen, which was then determined to be my grandmother's hair because it was also dyed. So the prosecution really wanted the jury to infer a lot when it came to the DNA. And I'll start with the button on that and what I mean by that. So they wanted the jury, and they being the prosecution or the prosecutor, wanted the jury to infer that that button came from Stephen, had been ripped off of his shirt during this struggle on the front yard, because they had determined that she was strangled on her front yard, on her front lawn. And that's why his DNA was on it. But when the science really came into play and the experts came in and testified, they could only say that there was a partial profile of his DNA on that button. They couldn't actually link the button to him. There was no missing button on any of his shirts, and his home was searched the day after this crime took place, and then again in 2001 when he was arrested, and neither time did they find a shirt with a missing button or a shirt of that specific brand. It was a specific button. It was a signature button of a Hathaway shirt. It was a three-hole button, and they never found a shirt of that brand either time anywhere in the home or on the property. So they couldn't link the shirt to Stephen, and the experts testified that there was actually no way to scientifically prove when the button even showed up on the lawn or how it got on the lawn. It could have been picked up and tossed, and that could have been done a month prior, weeks prior. They couldn't actually testify with any scientific certainty about those components, which are actually quite important because that takes the inferences that the prosecution wanted the jury to believe and turns those into quite a bit of reasonable doubt.
Right. So the hair that was found, where was that discovered?
So there were several hairs that were collected during this investigation, and they talked about some of them in the trial and some of them they did not. For example, there was like a clump of hair that was found on the lawn, which they bring up in trial, but they never speak to who it belonged to. And then there were some hairs from the forensic scientists as they were doing their investigation and when they found her body. So they linked those to the forensic scientists. But there was one hair that they found on her shirt. It was a 1 centimeter hair. It didn't have a root, so they had to do mitochondrial testing again, which linked it to my grandmother's maternal line. And then because it was dyed, linked it to my grandmother. So the prosecutor wanted the jury to infer that this hair had transferred from my grandmother to Stephen and then from Stephen to Kristen, though there were none of Stephen's own hairs found on her. But when it came up in the trial and the forensic experts were testifying, they said, you know, her body was dragged through several yards. And they proved that through the drag marks. So they said, yes, it is possible that that hair wound up on her shirt from being dragged through. It was around their van, which my grandmother had driven that day to church, and then through several other yards. But none of Stephen's hair was found on her, but one small piece of my grandmother's hair was. But there were also 2 unidentified hairs that were found on her shirt that to this day, we don't know who they belong to.
So they weren't Kristen's and they also weren't Stephen's.
And I think either way you look at those hairs, it's important because they didn't test all of the neighbors, but perhaps they would link those hairs today to some of those neighbors. And that further emphasizes the point of why, like, my grandmother's was on there. Or maybe those unidentified hairs would point to the actual criminal. So I think that these 2 unidentified hairs are so important to this case.
I didn't know that was discovered from my research. So that's interesting. So as far as the trial, the first one was a mistrial because they did not bring to evidence the confession call of the...
That's actually not correct. That was one of the points from this other podcast that was so alarming to our family because my uncle's lawyer, the defense lawyer, asked several times for a mistrial, 5 times to be exact, because of this tape, and he was denied each time. It was actually a mistrial because the jury could not reach a unanimous verdict. After 7 days, they were deadlocked. Mm-hmm. And so the judge had to declare it a mistrial. And then he went to a second trial a few months later.
Which I've heard, and it may have been a fact from that podcast, when that happens, that they can't make a unanimous decision together, and then it comes back again, 9 times out of 10, people are going to give in and become unanimous so they don't have to go through it all over again. So it is hard to see with the evidence provided how he could be guilty without reasonable doubt.
Exactly. And there was a lot of reasonable doubt. Now, you can be convicted on just circumstantial evidence, which is all that they had in this case. That can happen, but only if there's no reasonable doubt with that circumstantial evidence, which I don't believe to be this case. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write this story is because I would tell people all the time about this and they would almost not believe me because they'd think, how is that possible? And so I thought, well, I'm going to show you actually how that's possible. And I'm going to do it factually so that you can't say that I'm biased or not telling the truth. And I think if people reading the story, they look at all these testimonies and the things that are coming from the detective's mouths, not mine, they will see the reasonable doubt in this case.
Yeah. You don't sugarcoat him as being a perfect human being who did no wrong. You're just trying to lay out the facts.
Correct. And I wanted that to be clear. I wanted people to see that I wasn't leaving anything out. I wasn't trying to hide what might be considered bad. I wasn't trying to paint him as this perfect angel, but just as someone who was wrongfully convicted of a crime and someone whose mental illness was used against them to allow that to happen. A lot of people ask, what was the difference? Like, why was it a hung jury the first time and then a guilty verdict the second time? And I do think, you know, that's a great question for people to have. And you had even brought up how typically once there's a mistrial, if it's tried again, the favor goes to the prosecutor. They know everything that the defense is going to pull, and it usually goes in their favor. And in this case, there was no new evidence. There was nothing further that could link Stephen. I mean, if anything, it was showing more and more that he had no connection to this family, to this house, to this crime, anything. So the prosecutor really the second time had to rely on emotion. So the second trial fell over Mother's Day, and the amount of times it was continued to be reiterated that it was Mother's Day, and it's 8 years later, the same exact day, really pushing that point. And then because there was nothing new to offer, has the jury closed their eyes? And he relays this crime to them, how he interpreted it, comments that alleged statements that Stephen made under his alter ego, again, how he interpreted them with his own tone of voice. And then when he has the jurors open their eyes, there's pictures of Kristen all around the room.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing he says to them is, if you can picture anyone other than Stephen committing this crime, then let him go and send him back to the squalid room where they keep him.
Jeez.
You know, he had to pull on their emotions. It wasn't a factual closing argument. It was, how can I get this conviction when I don't have anything new to offer? Well, one way to do it is to really pull on the heartstrings of the jurors.
Paint that picture. So let's maybe get to the other theories of who you may think be responsible, or at least the other persons of interest that we touched on earlier.
Absolutely. So James Marr was, I believe, 18 at the time of Kristen's murder, but he had already had a felony conviction when he was interviewed by the detectives 5 months after this murder took place. He was, again, in a correctional facility. So he did have this violent history, but he also had a violent history with Kristen. And he, several months before her murder, had said that he wanted to rape and kill her. And several friends testified to that and told detectives that. Now, that's not the only connection they had. They obviously knew each other. He was dating one of her best friends, and they openly disliked each other, James Marr and Kristen did. And so did the other friends of this girl, because they didn't think that he was a good influence. They didn't want her to be dating him. But it was known that Kristen openly disliked him. And he apparently made those threats to her because she had interfered in this relationship, and the friend of Kristen's did break up with him. But he had also threatened his girlfriend and her mother, and obviously Kristen's being very serious. In addition to the threat that he made against her, he had been to her house before, and he also lived in that neighborhood. So he was also within close proximity. And a really interesting point that didn't come up in the first trial was that there was a torn up photo of him found in Kristen's garbage can when they went and did their initial investigation of the home.
Mm-hmm.
The issue was that this photo was mislabeled. It was labeled as the young man who picked her up for school. So for 8 years, this photo was labeled incorrectly. And that is all the way through the 5-year investigation, all the way through my uncle's first trial. And then the second trial, one of her friends stepped forward and said, "That's James Marr." So they said, you know, this threat that he made was 8 or 9 months before. And my uncle's lawyer was like, is there a limitation on a threat? Is there a cutoff of when that person is no longer able to carry out that threat? But when they found out that that photo was in her garbage can, that showed that there was a connection between the two up until the time that she was murdered. Also, there was a friend that said James Marr had a scratch on his face that she saw the day after the murder, to the point where a detective sketched it in his notebook as it was described to him. Now, because the detectives waited 5 months to question James Marr, the scratch wasn't there, but they also testified that they never asked him about it either. Mm-hmm. And when they went to interview him or to talk to him, he didn't want to give them his DNA. And they said this didn't heighten their suspicions at all, but he also had no alibi, which is something that my uncle did have and nobody else did. James Marr didn't have an alibi. He was high on cocaine that night. At one point, he lied and said that he was with his girlfriend, and the detectives spoke to her and she denied being with him. So he didn't know where he was, and he couldn't provide them with that.
And Stephen, I assume, was at home with his parents.
Yes, he was at home with their parents, and my grandparents actually wrote a pretty lengthy letter explaining his alibi and why they remembered that day so well, because of something that was going on with Stephen's grandmother at the time. So they remembered this day. It was also Mother's Day. But yes, he was home with them watching TV, and my grandfather had Parkinson's for 14 years, and he took the same medication from 8 a.m. to midnight every day for 14 years. And my grandmother gave it to him because he had poor eyesight because of his Parkinson's. So they were awake until midnight because that was the last time she would have to give him his medicine.
And how about Mr. Shalinsky?
So Anton Shalinsky had some friends in common with Kristen. He was also from that same neighborhood. He lived in that neighborhood and his family moved to Georgia. His parents did, and he went with them. But in 1996, he was leaving for the military. And before he did so, he stayed on Markwood Lane, which is just right there off of Cedar where this all took place. And he was staying with those friends. And so he was in the neighborhood at the time of her murder. In 2000, he had walked into a Georgia police station after he had gone back to live there. And he told them that he should be looked at as the prime suspect in this case. So the Georgia police, they interview him and they also record this interview. And then they find out the county he's talking about and they contact the detectives on the case in that county. And they put those detectives on a phone call with Anton Shalinsky, which was also recorded. Now, at the time, the police did not know that their conversation was being recorded. So a few days later, on April 11th, that video between the Georgia police and Anton Shalinsky, as well as his DNA sample, is sent to the detectives on this case. And they testified that they received the video, the lead detective and the team leader. They watched it together, and then they put that video in a drawer or filing cabinet in their office. They didn't label it and they never told anyone about it. So 3 years passed and that tape surfaced and it was given to the prosecution and to the defense. Now, the prosecutor at the time said he had nothing to do with this. And this is all happening in legal proceedings that are on the record, but not in the presence of the jury. And that's another thing that, you know, I'm in this unique position where I have this information, but at the time the jurors did not. And I think it paints a completely different picture when you see all of this. So he came in and the prosecutor told the judge what had happened and the judge was confused. He's like, well, who is this guy? Why does this matter? And he said, well, this individual confessed, it's on the tape. And he kind of was apologizing profusely, but he had no idea. Right then and there, obviously my uncle's lawyer is like, mistrial. They withheld this information for 3 years. He obviously submitted his request to have all of the videos at the beginning of the trial and nothing was turned over. So the judge at the time thought, okay, this might be what they call Brady material. And he's like, I need to listen to the video. And then also our lawyer's like, but who is this person? I want to interview him. I want to ask him questions. Nobody knows where he is. So the judge told the prosecutor, you need to locate him. You need to work with the police and you need to locate this Anton Shalinsky. So as the jury is coming in and out and listening to the trial, these conversations are continuing to happen day after day as it's progressing. They do locate Anton Shalinsky and the prosecution sends out their investigator, their private investigator. He questions his friends and he finds Anton Shalinsky in Montana. He's homeless and he continued this whole time to be an alcoholic and using drugs. And kind of a drifter. He is cleaned up and he's brought to New York so that he can go and stand up on the witness stand. Now, also what's going on in the background that the jury's not seeing are these conversations between the judge and the two lawyers about this tape. And so the judge asked, didn't you ask one of the detectives if anyone had confessed? And our lawyer said, yes, I did. And he said, no. And the prosecutor says, well, that was actually the same day that it was his last day on the job. He retired that day. So we have to rule him out. The other detectives, they haven't testified yet. So the judge says, we're not going to declare this a mistrial. We're just going to let those detectives come on to the stand and you get to cross-examine them and you get to ask them, why did they withhold this? Why didn't they turn this tape over? And so at this point, my uncle's lawyer had asked for a mistrial several times, but they didn't know that there was a phone recording and they were able to locate that and track it down. And that phone recording actually has that detective who was supposed to be retired, who said nobody confessed, It has him on the recording, and he's asking Anton Chelinski questions. He's asking him, where did you put her body? Did you go to her wake? So now we've got a detective who lied on the stand.
Perjury. I mean, I don't think he would forget that. That's a pretty big part.
That's a huge part. And it's so important because the judge said, wait a minute. He's going to need to come back and be re-cross-examined. Again, my uncle's lawyer is like, this has got to be a mistrial. We've got withholding of evidence. We've got perjury, you know, and the judge just keeps saying no. He keeps denying his requests. And he says, you know what? This detective needs to come back and he needs to be re-cross-examined. But he never came back. He never came back the first trial, and he never made an appearance at all the second trial.
I don't know how he has a choice. I feel like he should have to, if he's like on that recording.
But... Well, nobody called him. Nobody called him to the stand. Oh. The prosecution didn't call him as a witness.
Gotcha. So which one do you like for this crime? Or you just know it wasn't Stephen?
I know it wasn't Stephen. And I know that. And that's not just as a family member. That's just looking at the facts. That's looking at his mental illness and the fact that he didn't touch other people and he didn't like to be touched. Everything about this would be so out of character for him. But he was an easy target. He was what you would quote, the weirdo next door. The detectives knew he was mentally ill. They didn't have good evidence, but they also did not investigate. And to say who do I think it was, I mean, for me, it seems very likely that whether or not James Marr did this crime, he knows more than what was let on. And even to the point of why James Marr and Anton Chelinski were both excluded, right? Why they weren't considered suspects was because their DNA was not on the button. And that was it. And the detectives focused on that button so much to the point of they didn't investigate further. When they first got that phone call from Anton Chelinski, they tucked it away and they didn't say anything about it, but they never talked to his family. They never went to talk to him in person. And to quote them, they said he was a nut. So they are excluding him because his DNA is not on the button and because he's what they determined to be a nut and because he didn't have information that wasn't in the news. But then you have Stephen, who's actually diagnosed schizophrenic. He has a mental illness and they have the complete opposite approach with him. But also he didn't know anything. He didn't say anything that wasn't public knowledge either. And then you have James Marr, who has this violent past and an actual connection to Kristen and motive and no alibi.
Right.
And so many things pointing to him. Why was his picture ripped up in his garbage? Did he really have a scratch? She would have let him into her home. She would have opened the door for him. And that was something that my uncle's lawyer asked all of her friends who testified. She was supposedly scared of my uncle. And so he said, would she have ever opened the door for Stephen? And they said, absolutely not. But right. Would she have opened the door for James Marr? Probably. He had been there before.
Well, coming back to that, I don't know if, again, this was in that podcast or an article that I read, but when they searched the Manolis home, they supposedly found items that were stolen from other neighbors. So they were trying to make it seem like Stephen is breaking into other people's homes and stealing things. I don't know if they're just playing off of his previous crime with stealing the ring. But they assumed that he was in the Scarabelli home already.
Yeah, that was, I listened to this podcast with my dad, and the amount of times we looked at each other with our jaws dropped, like, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. And again, another reason why I just thought my story is going to be told factually is because I don't know. That wasn't mentioned.
Right.
That only came from the detective's mouth. But mm-hmm. I do know that the Scarabelli home was checked for fingerprints and there was nothing of Stephen's or anybody, you know, I don't know who they were specifically looking for, but definitely not Stephen's. And they had a lot of assumptions, I guess, their own theories, but nothing that ever, not even couldn't be proved, but there was no evidence to do so. And that was, again, a very easy thing for them to just say is like, oh, he was in their house. how do they know that? There's nothing that suggested that ever.
And you know, the neighbor that it is supposedly their item, he didn't report to the police that something was stolen. So it just kind of seemed to be convenient for them to say that. And it's interesting, right. If you hadn't even heard that and you're writing an entire book on the situation.
Yeah, definitely didn't come up in the trial. And I read the transcripts of both trials and all the supplemental information, psychiatric evaluations, and it was not in there.
Interesting. Well, I know it can be hard as a family member of Stephen Manolis to read headlines like, and I read this earlier today, sicko gets life for killing teen neighbor, because you didn't see him like that, a sicko. And it's hard. The media can definitely take things and twist it into their own way. And as an outsider, it's so easy to follow what the media tells you is true and show animosity towards the quote unquote killer. But we all have to realize that guilty or not, they have family too. And that things like this do affect them. It's not just the victims and their families, but I mean, I'm sure this has played a huge role in your life and your family's life as well.
Absolutely. This has been plaguing my family for years, because when you know so much about it and you talk about it over and over and you know all the injustices that have occurred, you can sit there all day long with your family and talk about your frustrations, but it doesn't do anything. It doesn't change anything. And during this process, my grandparents have died. Stephen's parents died. Now that I am a parent, it sort of changed the way that I looked at all of this, and to know that my grandparents gave everything they had, literally everything they had, to get a lawyer to fight for Stephen. My dad and my uncle John, also fought for their brother. They gave everything that they could. They were there at trial. They were supporting him. My dad retired from law enforcement. My dad had a very clear understanding of everything that was going on, and they kept meticulous records. The box of things that my father and my uncle kept, the amount of times my dad wrote his own stories to try and process all of this. I feel honored that I'm writing this story on their behalf, that I get to do this for them and for my grandparents who aren't here anymore, who don't have that voice. And also for Stephen, who doesn't have a voice because he's mentally ill. He didn't speak in his own defense because of that.
Let me ask you, is he planning to appeal his conviction?
There was an appeal that my grandparents, my father, and my Uncle John had put together shortly after his conviction, which was denied. And honestly, it's really hard to get appeals even looked at by a judge. And yeah, we could do that again. But I thought, this is my skill set, writing. This is my passion. And I want to give the entire story. I don't want to fill out a form per se. I want to put in everything from beginning to end, all of these moments that happened on the record, but not in the presence of the jury. So we have looked at doing that again, and also going through something like the Innocence Project. We originally tried in 2014, it would have been, to fill out the forms for that. But they were, at the time, I didn't have the transcripts, and they asked very detailed, specific questions. But also, they want, you know, Stephen had to sign those papers. Part of it was that they went and interviewed this person that you were filling it out for. And because of Stephen's mental illness, it just changes the way this works. Like, there's so many Instagram accounts right now of people who are fighting for their family members they believe were wrongfully convicted, and their family members will write things and they'll post them on their behalf, and they're working from the inside and the outside. And we're only working from the outside because Stephen can't.
Right. So you chose the title In the Dark of Night, which may or may not change once you're published. But once you do get published, because I know you're going to get published, you'll have to let me know when that happens, and I will be sure to share it with my listeners. It's not every day I get to talk one-on-one with someone so close to a case. So it's been really awesome to hear this story straight from you. Well, I truly appreciate you coming on and sharing your story with me and my listeners. if you want to follow Jennifer on Instagram, her handle is @writing_in_flux. If you would like to support my show, you can do so by leaving a rating on Spotify, a written review on Apple Podcasts, or leave a one-time donation at buymeacoffee.com/killerstories. You can follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok @killerstoriespodcast, and I'm on Twitter @killerstorypod. Maybe we'll have to do, once you get published, we'll have to do a little like book giveaway or something fun like that.
I would love that.
Yeah. But as always, thanks so much for listening. Until next time, this has been a killer story.